instructs the Speaker to establish a committee for the fact-finding mission. Now, this committee, in terms of the judgment, needs to be constituted in terms of specific rules, and its mandate must be spelled out clearly as well. Because these were the things that were raised by the court to say, your ad hoc committee system does not have this, so therefore your system is not sufficient to deal with the Section 89 motion. So we need to have that in the rules to say what's the structure of the committee, what's its size, what's its party representation, how is it going to take a decision to make that recommendation. That came out as well in the judgment. It appears that there was, and I must watch my words here, there was a reference to what we know as the Mazibuko case. The Mazibuko case deals with the motion of no confidence, but that motion of no confidence didn't reach the Assembly, because in the programming committee, it didn't pass a certain level of consensus. So the court, the majority at least, was very concerned that in this preliminary phase, in the predetermined phase, that the whole Section 89 process stops there. So what we need to ensure in the rules is that the process will continue to reach the Assembly. So in other words, even if the majority in a committee decides, but this was not a serious violation, I'm going to say something about serious violation of the Constitution as well. If the majority decides it wasn't, that report still needs to be debated in the House. It's almost as we go back to the Ambrosini judgment to say, when there's a member's bill, that although the committee decides that the member's bill should not proceed, it must still be debated in the House, because that is where the public gets an opportunity to see what's going on, and that's the whole purpose of having a parliament. So I think the principle there is it must be sure that Chair, if I can refer members to paragraph 232 of the Chief Justice's judgment. Although he was in the minority, he summarizes the majority judgment there, and he sets out the principles in paragraph 232. He says he must not use the numerical strength to frustrate the tabling and debating of impeachment motions in order to shield the president who is their leader. So I think I've said enough about that. And then, of course, the purpose, the inquiry of the committee should be spelled out in the rules. So, Chair, what the majority said to Parliament is to say, you do not have rules, you must have specific rules. What you have at the moment is insufficient, and you have to do this within a reasonable time. And there's correctly some confusion about the timelines. It appears, and we don't see it in the majority judgment, that there were timelines spelled out, 120 days and 180 days. The reference is made in the Chief Justice's judgment on that, and of course in the media summary. But somewhere along the line, the majority judgment must have taken it to heart and removed the specific timelines and just referred to Section 237 of the Constitution that it says that it must be done without delay. Now, without delay means as soon as reasonably possible. It doesn't give us indefinite time. It means that we must do everything in our power to get this done. But because of certain things, we don't have a specific 120 days to take a decision on this, Chairperson. So, Chair, I think what one can say about this court case is there was a huge attempt, or I would rather say a fundamental attempt by the judges to say we are not overstepping the separation of powers. Of course, there's a difference of opinion. The Chief Justice thinks this is a classic case of judicial overreach. And the majority then made a special effort through the judgment of Judge Froman to say, well, we're not overstepping. We're just saying to Parliament, you're expected to do something in terms of Section 89. You must do it. And that's a point that I think needs to be looked at as well, Chairperson. It says that when you have this evidence, when there is something going on, you must look at Section 89. You must implement it. We can't just sit and wait for it. So there's a kind of an obligation almost on Parliament to deal with Section 89. It doesn't come out clearly whether we must proceed or whether there's an obligation on a certain party or a member to then bring a motion, or whether we should even wait for a motion, or whether the House can move it without a motion. But I mean, I can't see how you can move it without a motion, but it says that you haven't done anything in terms of 89 and therefore you must do something. It's almost like they said in Doctors for Life, if you do not get public participation going on a bill before you, you have to go out and solicit comments. You have to go find comments. You have to do whatever you can to get comments so that you have public participation. It's an obligation put on you. So that is something I think one must look at in the rules, because there might be a situation where there's a for lack of a better word, information in the media that points to a violation of the Constitution, but nobody moves that motion in the House. What should the House do in a situation like that? Chair, I'm going to, I mean, I can take questions on the chairperson, but I think in terms of what we need to do in this committee, giving effect to the judgment is to look at those principles. I think the majority of them are captured in 232 of the Chief Justice opinion and draft something according to those lines, Chairperson. If you like, I can summarize it again, but I think I'm just going to repeat myself.
As we are trying to summarize a very detailed judgment. And that's fine, and thank you for that. And let us allow Honourable Steenhuisen to come in.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thanks, Mr. Jenkins, for the input there. Obviously, you know, the case is, it's going to be a very difficult tightrope for us to walk to make sure that we're able to satisfy all the requirements. But to my mind, one of two of the key issues that I think we're going to have to grapple with as they relate to the judgment is around Section 89 itself and going back to what Section 89 says. And I think that one of the key elements that we're going to have to grapple with as a committee, because it's going to have a knock-on effect on whether a prima facie evidence exists, and you know that's the rule as it's currently drafted for us, talks a lot about prima facie case. Again, to your point about who moves the motion and what triggers. So, to me, the first thing that we're going to have to grapple with is
a point of order. Sorry, Honourable Steenhuisen. I don't think we want to allow this. People must stay to the gallery there, take photos from there. Please, Honourable Mdagani, you must protect us.
It's for my Farmers Weekly shoot.
Yeah, I think there's some things that must be clarified.
The Farmers Weekly have offered me the centerfold this week.
No.
Why are you for rules, man? So, please.
So.
But of course, this is parliamentary staff.
Yep, then you should know. You can't.
Okay, no, we'll take the point. Let us move on.
Thank you.
John, you wanted to.
No, I'm busy working. I was just getting worked up. just to say that I think we're going to have to go back to Section 89, particularly if the rule's going to start dealing with prima facie, and determine and decide what is a serious violation of the Constitution. Because Section 89 uses the word serious violation of the Constitution or the law. How do we define a serious violation? And we're going to have to try and find some clarity around what is a serious violation. What Dr. Ndlozi may think is a serious violation, the Speaker of the National Assembly may not regard as a serious violation. So I think that's one of the first things we're going to have to grapple with. So before we even get into the rule and the prima facie, that's one thing we're going to have to do with. The second dilemma that I think we have, and perhaps we could seek some guidance from you in this regard, is that I think there are two different scenarios. There's a scenario where a Member of Parliament believes that the President has seriously violated the Constitution and tables a motion. And I think there's a process to follow, and we've dealt with that type of process going forward, and the Constitutional Court has said that the process is deficient. But what happens when the Constitutional Court rules that the President has violated the Constitution? And I'm unsure about what happens then and the ability of Parliament to then set up a committee that would second guess or perhaps arrive at a different conclusion to a finding in the Concord of what they regard as a serious violation. And what would then be the trigger to put that before the House? Would that be a finding by the Constitutional Court automatically trigger a process in the National Assembly, or would the Speaker be obliged then to trigger that process in the National Assembly? I think one of the dilemmas that we have is, how does a committee of Parliament take a constitutional court finding that the President has violated the Constitution and then adopt a committee process to embark upon Audi Ultram Partem, which would have already taken place in a Concord process, And then arrives at a different conclusion to the Congress as well. We disagree with the Concord that it was a violation of the Constitution or a serious violation of the Constitution. So to my mind, we're going to have to look at two different streams. One to deal with the tabling, the ordinary tabling of a motion in terms of Section 89, and a second stream to deal with a Concord finding that the President has. And I think that we're going to have different processes around it. So that's just I think that's a dilemma that I think we're going to have to grapple with before we even get into the functioning of the rule. Thank you.
No, thanks a lot, Chair. I think Honorable Steenhuisen has in part covered me on the issues of what constitutes a serious violation, because the term is debatable. And quite frankly, I think that lands us in some sort of a jiffy. And I think that needs clarity. I heard Advocate Jenkins, of course, they will come back to that particular aspect. Secondly, Chair, I think the biggest problem comes into how parliaments actually operate. Because fundamentally, a decision is taken on the basis of a vote. Now, how do you then create a new decision-making process? Because I'm looking at the scenario as an example of an ad hoc committee. Generally, the standing operating procedure of Parliament now is that an ad hoc committee will have 11 members, which 6 will come from the ANC, 2 from the DA, 1 from the EFF, and 2 of the other parties. Now, ordinarily, it becomes one of those 50+1 situations. Now, I'm not sure whether we can then subject a legal process to a vote, whereas the motion of no confidence does that. It's a political outlook, right? We're really not happy about how you're doing A, B, C, D. But Section 89 is looking at constitutional violations. And what's the deadlock-breaking mechanism in that regard? Because if we are unable to clarify that, a parliamentary process in whatever way, which will do the fact-finding mission, we'll have to agree on some sort of report, and then that report then come to the House, which of course ordinarily then we have to vote, which is fine. But the spade work before that requires a deadlock-breaking mechanism, and the parliamentary practice is a vote. So that subjects it, by and large, to a political intervention as opposed to a legal outlook of which is before us. It may well be a different case if, of course, like the Constitutional Court found that the President currently had breached, you know, the Constitution. But even there, as Honorable Steenhuisen says, when you then establish an ad hoc committee which seeks to unravel a finding, seeks to arrive at a different conclusion, it becomes a total roundabout of madness. So I really, really hope that we can get that guidance, because I think it's at the heart of how any fact-finding mission would operate in terms of breaking a deadlock on what type of report would you submit. Because if you can't agree there, the House is going to act on the basis of what you present to them. And if it says, well, you know what, we've looked at this and we don't consider it to be serious, go jump, the House is left with no other conclusion other than to respond to what that fact-finding established committee or whatever, whether it's a standing committee or whatever you call it. Fundamentally, it's constrained by current norms, that the only way to arrive at a decision is through a vote, because rarely we know that consensus becomes a norm on controversial issues in Parliament generally, whether it's this one or the next. Thanks, Chair.
Honorables in the subcommittee, and then if we do that, I think members won't mind to do that. Mbuyiseni, won't mind that we do that. In the subcommittee general, we try to be as informal as possible. That you don't use honorable, honorable, honorable.
The problem is when we disagree, you're going to start reminding us.
Honorable Mather.
Chairperson, I listen to what the colleagues say, and we shouldn't complicate things. There's a huge distinction between Section 102 and Section 89. As far as I'm concerned, Section 102 is a more political process. The opposition party may have a problem with the president, and they want to score political points, and they come with a motion of no confidence. Section 89 is something completely different. That's why the test is also a much higher test. You need a two-thirds majority in the House. And Section 89 deals where you remove the president from office, and the Constitution clearly states there are three instances. It must be a serious violation of the Constitution. Even in the Nkanda judgment, when the court found that there was a violation of the Constitution, the court did not say it was a serious violation. The court could have said that. It didn't say that. When you deal with Section 89, it's almost a factual kind of situation where it should be so obvious that almost all the members, or two-thirds, or even 100% should agree that this individual should be removed from office. For example, in subsection C, where the person cannot fulfill his office, the person suffered a stroke, for example. It's obvious the person should be removed. And the other two deals with serious misconduct or a serious violation. And then you should start looking at intent and those kind of things when you get to that position. But we shouldn't complicate it. There's a huge difference when we come to 89 compared to 102, which is basically, as far as I'm concerned, a more political process. This is a factual process. It shouldn't be that difficult.
Well, thank you very much, Chairperson. I think Honorable Stanley hasn't somehow covered me, because quite frankly, when you look at Section 89, it may not be easy to deal with one section of it or subsection of it. You can't deal with A and leave B and C. So, which means then, when we look into these matters, we'll have to deal with that section in total, A, B, and C. And also, I think the issue of the focus is very important, because we are dealing here with the matter of the court judgment, and that should be our focus, and then we create principles around that. What did the court say? You know, with regard to the majority judgment of the court. Now, that's where we should begin. I should therefore, I mean, Honorable Stevenson is saying it's going to be a dual process. On one hand, we're going to look at the rules. At the same time, we look at the court judgment. And of course, these can be looked at into simultaneously. For instance, Chairperson, the majority judgment said a prerequisite for such removal was contingent on a factual inquiry into whether one of the three listed grounds in Section 89(1) was present, that is, serious violation of the Constitution or the law, serious misconduct, and inability to perform the functions of office. So I think we should put that in mind as we deal with these matters, and then we come to a conclusion of the court judgment. What is it that the court said the parliament must do? It was held that the assembly failed to put in place proper rules regulating a Section 89(1) procedure. It was also held that there was failure by the assembly to properly determine whether the president had breached Section 89(1) of the Constitution, and it was a violation of et cetera, et cetera. So I think we've got to put our minds around that so that we be more focused on what we're trying to say. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Look, I think I appreciate this workshopping, and maybe we should be patient with each other to establish a common understanding of the judgment. We must not falter our interpretation. So we have to be very clear that we have appreciated fully what the judgment is. Now, the confusion, and I mean, this is a a thing with judgments like this is that they are serious judges or justices that give very powerful, counter arguments and so on and so forth. But the majority judgment holds the dictates. That's the first point of departure, the majority judgment. Yes, we can appreciate the counter argument of the Chief Justice and its brilliance, but in relation to taking our key, how do we implement the majority judgment? And that's the first thing that's important here. And therefore, it seems to me that the bridge of the separation of powers comes precisely in a value judgment on the establishment of seriousness. So a court, if it is sensitive, in my view, not to remove a president directly, it will not add the word serious violation. That is where it is giving us a bridge. What the inquiry therefore does, which I think the two examples that the Honorable Steenhuisen gives are very crucial. We're making rules for the future, but we have a delinquent as well in question who has been properly ruled to have violated the Constitution by the highest court in the land. But what didn't happen is that nobody has heard his side of the story. Nobody has heard his response, oral evidence, and it comes out in the judgment. We don't know, and if we are to establish seriousness, we need to all hear, did this guy had the intention to undermine the public protector's work in the investigation in Nkandla? Or as he said in his apology, he was just ill-advised or he did not understand the law. We have to be able to attach intention and say, no, you have intentionally undermined and therefore it's a serious violation. So we must establish that factually, that there is a serious violation. The second part is, what do the members of parliament vote on? So, and in my view, and you'll see why we think later on, what we would propose is that that factual finding mission or factual finding process must be as much as possible conducted by legal experts, because it's a fact-finding mission. This happened, he has the right to present, to hear his side of the story, like in a company. The company, if the CEO has done something wrong, they get somebody from outside, some senior counsel, to do a report and recommend. So you could have been found guilty and there are sanctions to the guilt. Sanctions, the removal from office, or take your salary for 12 months and so on and so forth. But the board still needs to decide, because the CEO cannot be removed by somebody who is outside the company, who is not a member of the company. That's a fact-finding mission. And a Section 89, according to the judgment, needs an inquiry before a debate can happen, which establishes for us the facts. Now, that, I think, the first two violations are different to the third. For an example, as the Honorable Mulder says, if a person is too old, and maybe he is not aware that he's old, he sleeps in parliament, he cannot lift up a pen, we must agree that this person must be removed from presidency. Or he's suffered a stroke, like one of the presidents of apartheid, and he's still in denial that he cannot perform. Members of parliament must save the country, because it's going to take dangerous decisions. Or there is a psychiatric report that this guy or this lady has gone mad, or has suffered some psychological, he can no longer be rational, and so on and so forth. That's why, on the last why, I think you can't take all the benefits, because it's capacity, as it were. So that would be my interpretation, or it's not even an interpretation, it's very clear in the majority judgment. That's what we are called to do. Even if there would be a court judgment, I remember in the interrogation what the Chief Justice was struggling with is, he says, for instance, okay, if we find that the president has indeed committed murder and then we do not take him to prison, don't you think that's a serious violation? I may think so, But they must still, Parliament must still go subject itself as long as you don't send him to prison. If you don't send him to prison, you are saying Parliament must go see it because you have said it's a sanction cause. For if you thought it was serious, why didn't you send him to prison? So for as long as they don't send the president to prison, we have to have our own satisfactory inquiry as a separate arm of the state. That is at least what my interpretation is. Thank you.
Chairperson, I indeed agree. I think the processes are two here. Because remember, we're Parliament, we're not a court of law. So this would still be largely political to a large extent, this process. It's the seriousness of the issue, because you are talking about a violation of the Constitution, where we need to have a process that ensures that the President accounts fully to Parliament about his mistakes. I mean, for example, if you have a situation where the President has done something, you can't impose criminal penalties as Parliament, right? The courts of law would do that. But I think what Honorable Steenhuisen is saying, which we agree with fully, is that firstly there must be that political process internally in Parliament to say how do we table a motion in terms of Section 89 of the Constitution and have that and outline that parliamentary process. But at the same time to say that there might be instances or few incidents like the where there was a constitutional court judgment, how do we also process that internally to arrive at a similar or more or less the same outcome? But I think I was chuckling here when I heard Honorable Nkosi saying that we should invoke the ideal alteram partem principle for the president so that he can come and explain his side of the story. And I agree with him fully. I wasn't chuckling because he made that point, but it reminded me of the SABC inquiry. We were saying exactly the same point about Claudi. I think it's important that we apply it across the board and consistently in future. So I think that's how we need to apply our minds to these things. I think these are impeachable offenses. Even though they are highlighted in the Constitution, we can't expect the very same sections to explain serious violation to us. That is what this process must do. And while Advocate Jenkins was speaking at the beginning, right when he was providing his analysis, I thought it's one of the issues that he was going to touch on, because he said he was going to return to it later. I don't know whether it's later today or at some other time in future. I don't know. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. You see, in a democracy that is constitutionally based, I think we'd have to continuously check and work within that constitutional arrangement. Yes, we have established the Constitutional Court, and at this moment we do give respect to what the Constitutional Court has said, and we'll have to comply with that. But I think Hlengwa is raising a fundamental point, which is a little bit of a political problem, and also it relies on the votes, the issue of the proportionality. As a member of parliament, you get recognized inside the house. But the experience is, which is quite something that I want the legal person to talk, is that you are a member of an ANC or you are a member of NFP. What happens? If the motion comes through you from the minority party, quite clearly the ANC might respond totally different. And then the political debate more than the detail of how that relationship is shaped. So it's important for this committee to look into that a little bit deeper, that at which stage and what capacity, because you can't just say as rules, we give you the authority to raise the motion, whilst you know for a matter of fact that when you stand in the House, we look at your party credentials more than looking at the motion itself. And then the problem starts. You become more isolated and nobody comes to your rescue. And for me, that debate in the rules must be resolved. That how do we deal with that? We should not fudge it, because that's the realities that we are dealing with. If it deals with saying Yes, the majority party is in existence, but what do you do with this particular motion, which is very crucial, because you must never be seen not to give respect to it, because even an individual has come to a conclusion that the president has not complied with the Constitution. What do we do? Because that right of that individual in the House becomes very much important, and the rules themselves must protect that particular individual and give him the power to be able to rise at that particular moment, and so that he can either take the process to the last with the speaker and in all the other ways. But it's all dependent on how do we design the rules themselves to protect minorities in the House itself. If you can deal with that, because it's fundamentally touching on the voting patterns. So for me, that's the challenge that the rules must be able to deal with, that what do we do within that environment? And then the last one, Chairperson, or from what I hear, I think that substantially that's what we want. That's why I'm saying that from ours, where we sit at, as would want to encourage, yes, the judgments are there, but in the near future, would it be necessary for the Constitutional Court to direct members of Parliament how to act? When you have established the rules, it means automatically the power of each individual in the House becomes very important and it needs to be protected. That's the point. I'm just saying that can we get more clarity about it, or can we get more guidance into it, that what must we do when the minorities or individuals in Parliament feel unprotected? You see, because you can't determine what is going to be the voting outcome. You see, and if the voting outcome says the ANC is in the minority, what do you do? You see, and the ANC thinks that the president is not conducting himself in terms of the Constitution. How do you protect that? Because that's the value of our Constitution, that we must protect each other. The majority is not, can't be the total determinant of how the country comes to resolve a particular challenge. But this has been the experience in the past, that if the majority party decides, then nobody knows what to do with this party, even if there's total dissatisfaction with the running of that particular office called the president. What do you think, Advocate Jenkins?
Honorable Mazoni wanted to make a point, but because we have been part of the team, may I just make a point? I just think that sometimes because of the current situation, we are really focusing on the current situation. We also ignore that we started reviewing the rules of National Assembly long before any judgment. Long before any judgment. Therefore, we must put ourselves, what would have said without all the judgment, to ensure that we give effect to Section 89 of our Constitution. And then, because if we don't do it that way, I think then we'll have a problem. And I think we must try our level best to do so, because we are setting the rules, formulating the rules, surely for future generations, for future parliaments, and therefore, because it seems now, really, we are almost like we are in impeachment. We are just regulating it and ensure that we give effect to 89 of the Section 89, the point as made by Honorable Melda. Let us do it that way. And then because once we take ourselves to a current situation, surely we are not going to draft what we in fact would have drafted long time ago, before all the judgment were in fact were given on that, because we are working on it already. And then that's why then there are proposals that are put forward for your consideration. Maybe after Honorable Mazoni, we should allow then Honorable Jenkins again to make a general comment on some of the issues that are raised, and we go to proposal, because many of you already are touching on proposals. And then once we go to proposal, then we can then have a discussion on some of the issues on that. But my view is that let us take away that there's a current situation, that we're drafting this rule long before it. Of course, there's judgment that we respect, but we are drafting the rules, not necessarily for the judgment only, because we already started drafting the rules. Let us then move in that understanding on that. Otherwise, again, we subject ourselves really on the issue that Honorable Melda was raising, the question of seriousness, and all the issue that was raised in there. I think that is very valid on that. Mazon, you want to take a platform?
Chair, thanks. Chair, I've been on the subcommittee since 2014, and in 2014 we first started debating how we would give effect to Rule 89. The problem is that we stopped debating it before we should have. We should have continued the debate, and that's why we faced with the problem that we faced with now. Chair, in 2014, this committee discussed certain issues which have now come up in this Concord judgment. So it's very difficult to separate ourselves as we talk now, because we do have this Concord judgment that we I think we foresaw the inevitability of there being perhaps a Concord judgment that would essentially lead this committee as it has done so now. Now, in 2014 already, the option of having an external panel was mooted. And at the time, we discussed as a committee that an external panel was certainly not the way to go, because the executive is held to account by Parliament. It is one of our roles. It is a constitutional obligation that we as members of Parliament have, is to hold the executive to account. So already when this was discussed in 2014, that was already something that was taken away. What was, however, identified as being a huge flaw was the fact that our ad hoc committee system, as the rules make provision for presently, had two fundamental flaws. The one is that it would not give effect to a constitutional court recommendation or requirement. So we had to come up with a committee that would give effect to the constitutional court requirement or mandate given to Parliament. And this is why we sit in the position we do now. We now have the Concord telling us you have to make a committee that gives effect to our recommendations and to our requirements. So that was the first conundrum, which we knew would come up. The second was the fact that Parliament in a ad hoc committee, or in a committee that would have to be established to give effect to 89, could not create law on the fly. That wasn't the role of this committee. The role of this committee would not be to create a law. It would be to give effect to a problem that existed within Parliament. So in other words, what we were looking at, and we looked extensively at things such as what happens in the United States of America, where they call a congressional hearing, for example. And their judicial commission then sits with a group of senators who act as a jury, and the president comes before them. An interesting fact is that over 60 possible impeachments have come before the American Senate since 1813, and only a third of them have actually ever seen it come to actual trial, with two American presidents being impeached in that period. So we can see that it's even in very mature democracies that have gone through this process numerous times, there are challenges and impediments as they come along. And what we must realize with these rules, and that's why it's problematic that we didn't continue with the drafting of these rules as a subcommittee, is that these rules are not static. As we develop and as things occur, so we will have to change and adapt the rules to adapt to certain situations. And that's normal, because we're not drafting rules for the current government. We draft rules for any possible government that comes into Parliament, and we must always bear that in mind. But Chair, I think where we deviating now and where we possibly are straying is, as Honourable Steenhuisen and Honourable Kwankwa and Honourable Klenga and Honourable Boy and the doctor sitting, Dr. Ndlozi sitting opposite me have said, is that until we have a fundamental understanding of what would constitute a serious offence, we actually can't go further to discuss what kind of committee could look at that offence, because we first have to understand what the context of a serious breach is. And that was also viewed, and in 2014 we were saying at that time, how do we establish what a serious breach is? It's the same thing as gross abuse or gross misconduct. We have to, as a committee, accept that this is one of the very tough challenges that we face, is to define what serious breach, gross misconduct. We have to define these things in our rules. And we can't expect the National Assembly table to make these decisions on our behalf in the House, because we've already seen through various court actions what happens when we expect the NA table to take these decisions on our behalf. But Chair, fundamentally, one of the reasons that the very first rule that we changed as a subcommittee was we added the word, the Speaker of the House must act in an impartial fashion. Because if the Speaker of the House is not 100% impartial, you land up with a Mazibukova Speaker of Parliament scenario, where an opposition party, or even for that matter, someone from the governing party might feel that the Speaker has acted in a way that is not independent and fair to the House. So in all of this, we must remember fundamentally, we saw this problem coming, and that's why we said that the Speaker must act in a completely impartial manner. Because as Advocate Jenkins said, what happens in a case where it gets brought before the Speaker and the Speaker says, well, actually, I don't think this is a problem. And I loved what Honourable Klengwa said when he said, and then the committee's told to go and jump. Because let's be honest, that can happen if the Speaker is not completely 100% impartial. And Chair, my last comment on all of this is, when we draft these rules, part of what we draft must make sure that the rules of Parliament protect us from the majority of Parliament ever holding the power to disregard the opposition parties in any way, shape or form. That's why we have rules of Parliament. It's to protect from absolute power projecting onto Parliament absolutely. Thank you, Chair.
Then this, they must have something to drink. Advocate Kubisa will come in. Kubisa, want to come now?
Chairperson, just one thing. One point is that the point that is coming out, emerging from this, that when we draft the rules, we must also consider the fact that we draft them for posterity as well. That's one. Two, I would appreciate from now onwards that when we're giving a direction, that perhaps it be in a point form so that we're able to follow it coherently. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. No, I think the discussion so far was very valuable and very valid points were made that we all can learn from. When Advocate Jenkins presented his input, he referred to a certain paragraph in the Constitutional Court judgment, and that spells out the mechanisms. And I think that is the first pillar that we need to focus on and to discuss. Secondly, our job as a subcommittee is to implement and give effect to the Constitutional Court judgment. That's the second principle. And this is what we're here for and to reach consensus on this. The third one is what members has referred to. We are making decisions that will stand for many, many years to come, not only on the short term, but for the longer term as well, well past the fifth term of Parliament. So we have a draft rule dated from 2016, and I think the purpose of this committee is to refine that draft rule and to discuss the draft rule and to see how we can improve it. And lastly, then we must respect the parliamentary processes from the subcommittee to the rules committee to the House with consultations so that we don't violate the parliamentary constitutional processes of this body. So I really support what you've said before you give to Advocate Jenkins, that we really take note of the discussion, but that we focus on what Honourable Glawley said. Let us focus on the principles and let us see how do we move it forward to make a practical decision recommendation to the Rules Committee. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Chair, and sorry to labour the point, but, and I've listened to what's been said, but why I raised the point about what constitutes serious up front is because it's going to bedevil the process the whole way through if we don't have some consensus around what is a serious concept. And I say that because I heard what Dr. Ndlozi said around the committee determining the seriousness, and that's all well and good, and we can embark upon that process. But my concern is that, if one looks at the current rule before us, there's a process that has to take place before the motion even gets to the House. And that's that the Speaker has to satisfy herself, before it even appears in the order paper, that it meets the prescripts of Section 89. Now, I would regard a violation of the oath of office as a serious violation of the Constitution.
a speaker, I'm not saying this speaker, I'm saying a speaker, could say, oh, well, that's just a mere formality that you have to forego before, that's not a serious violation. And so I think that's the point I tried to make, is that because what could happen is that a speaker could gong the process out before, you know, it even passes the first hurdle on the basis that, in her opinion, it's not a serious violation. And I think that's why I raised it up front. It's something we're going to have to grapple with, this issue of what is our common understanding as a subcommittee of the rules, or the rules committee and parliament ultimately, of what is a serious violation. Otherwise, we're going to end up with skirmishes the whole way down the process because, you know, what I regard as a serious violation of the Constitution could simply be dismissed as, no, it doesn't meet the prescripts of 89. Therefore, the motion can't even appear before the House. And then we'd have to find ourselves in court again, having to go and, you know, asking the Constitutional Court once again to interpret what is a serious violation. So I think that's the context in which I raised it. I mean, I've no doubt that an ad hoc committee or the committee would be able to determine what is a serious violation. But my concern is that if we don't have a common understanding before the process even starts of what is a serious violation, then, you know, we're going to have to grapple with it at each phase. So it was in that context that I raised, and that's why I sought some guidance from Honourable Jenkins about whether there's any case law around what is a serious violation, what constitutes a definition of serious.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I think to address the questions, I think there's a lot of similarities between the questions. And yes, I said I'll come back to the issue of seriousness without delay, and I'm going to come back to that now, and I'm kind of happy that I left it for members to give input before I put my head on the block for this matter. The issue of seriousness, whether it's defined or not, where does it fit in the process, is critical and it's crucial. It's the crux of the matter for me. I think if we deal with it in a process way of a member bringing the motion, or, as Honourable Steen has said, what if the Crown Court makes a finding that there's been a violation of the Constitution and no member brings a motion? What is the responsibility of Parliament then to deal with that court case? As I said in my initial input, I think the court expects Parliament to do something even in that circumstance, to deal with that judgment, to say there's a judgment out there that says the President has breached the Constitution or a law, or is guilty of misconduct, or is incapable of performing the function, and then the Section 89 procedure must kick in. So we need to keep that in mind into initiating the process. Then when the process starts, the first point of call is, of course, the predetermination of whether one of those three grounds exists. And I think the focus is more on A and B rather than C. A and B being misconduct, that's B, C being the violation of law or the Constitution, which must be serious. First of all, I would agree with Dr. Ndlozi that it would be overstepping the judicial function to actually make a finding to say this is serious and therefore Parliament must take notice. Section 89 says to determine whether it's serious and the court case together is a function of Parliament. It's not a function of the court. The court, in terms of section, I think it's 167, must make a finding whether there has been a breach of the Constitution. And if there's a breach, it must declare that action or law invalid. Well, not invalid, but to declare it unconstitutional, then it can make a just and equitable order. So it won't be for a court to say it's serious. Now, I don't have to go into the minority-majority disagreement on this point of what is serious and whether we can determine it. The minority had a different view. The majority says you need to determine it. I think what the majority had in mind is to say, write it down so that we can have a process that is removed from the political agenda at that point. So what is serious? That's going to be a very difficult question. For me, there's two ways of which we can approach it. One is to say the certain action is serious. Honourable Steenhuisen mentioned a breach of the oath of office. Honourable Mulder said, look at intent, look at the reason why it's there. Is it gross negligence or intent? Usually that focuses on seriousness. But in law, and the judgment of Justice Zondo said, there's no definition for seriousness in law, so we can accept that. We're not going to have a definition. Parliament will have to determine its own definition. So I would, when I thought about this prior to hearing the inputs, but I'm glad that there's some agreement at least on that point for me, I also thought of, what about gross negligence and intent? Regardless of what provision in the Constitution is being breached, that would constitute seriousness. Now, I think to make the debate around this a little bit easier, given the context of Parliament, which is made up of different political parties, I think it's very important to remember that the Constitutional Court clearly states that the fact-finding predetermination process, the sort of committee process to find out whether there's been a serious violation, is separate from actually debating the motion and voting on the motion. So even if we have a process, now remember what I, or let me just remind myself as well, to make the debate around finding a definition for serious easier within the political context of Parliament, we must remember that whatever definition we give it, your political affiliation is going to be lived out in the House, not in the committee. The committee is going to have a different process. And one needs to understand it actually, and I need to understand the court case, because the court case highlights the composition and the voting procedure within the committee as possible impediments for that process to get to the House. But the way Parliament operates is that we have to have proportional representation in committees. It must be in a manner consistent with democracy, and we must pass decisions in the committee in a manner consistent with democracy. So that is there. It's very difficult to get around it. But if we think that, okay, whatever fact-finding mission we do, we get to the House, at that point, even if there was a finding that said it was a serious misconduct or a serious violation, the House can still decide what they want to do with the president. That's because Section 89 says the president may be removed, not must be removed. So he may be removed. He or she may be removed. So, Chairperson, the issue of seriousness, I would suggest it's going to be easier to look at a definition when we're looking at intent, you know, what they call in law mens rea, but I mean, we've passed the Latin ages now, so is it intentional? Was there gross negligent part of that? And to get to that point, certainly we'll have to allow the president to give input into the process. Whether that's written or oral, I think that would be for the rules to determine or for the committee to decide, and that's something that we can keep in mind. That being said, when we get to the second stage of the process, just on the point of audi alteram partem, when we get to the second stage of the process, I would also suggest that when the House is going to take a decision to remove or not to remove the president should also be afforded an opportunity to say something in the House. It can't be just at the fact-finding process. And secondly, during the fact-finding process, one must also consider whether the president gets legal representation or is entitled to legal representation. Certainly, there's been reference in the court case to that. And given the seriousness of losing your benefits, I would suggest that it should be seriously considered that should be allowed. It is a more of a legal fact-finding process. Chairperson, I think the issue of protection of minorities, I haven't specifically referred to it, although I've touched on it, because I've just categorized all the questions in three areas. One is the seriousness, which I think I've dealt with. One is how do we bring that motion into the House, or the issue into the House, even if no one moves a motion. And the last thing is the protection of minorities. I think this was said in the context of what I said before, of the report of the committee or the whole issue not being debated in the House. Section 42 is very clear that the National Assembly is there for public debate of national issues. So there must be a debate on this. It's not predetermined that because you have seriously violated the Constitution, you must be removed. I've said that already. But there must be a debate. So to deal with that, the rules must make it clear that whatever is said, or let's assume that there's going to be different views within a fact-finding mission or within the committee process, even at that stage. I'm saying that because I think most people will look with the eye onto the future. You do what you do today, you've got your eye on the future. So you know there's going to be a debate in the House. I'm not going to sit here in a committee and agree that there was a serious violation. I'm going to try and shield my president. Let's just take that for example. So let's assume that there will be different views within the committee. I think the rules must spell out, like with the case of legislation, that the committee can also then record minority views, something in that line. But what it would be necessary is that you give that protection to minorities, as Honorable Zoni has said. I mean, the court expects that to happen. It cannot be that the minorities and their views are disregarded in this process. So, again, the rules there must... We have some examples in our rules of how to get a report with different views out there. I suggest we look at that again in the report. And then, obviously, the rules of debate needs to take that into consideration as well. Chairperson, let me leave it at that point for now. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Chair, two things quickly, which I think are very clear in the majority judgment. So I'm going to read it. What Justice Jafta does is to mention Section 89. And this is an important point we must be absolutely and crystally clear about. This provision empowers the Assembly, and the Assembly alone, to remove the President from office. He quotes Section 89, and he says, this provision empowers the Assembly and the Assembly alone to remove the President from office. The drafters of the Constitution were alive to the fact that the need to remove a sitting President from office may arise. Hence, this section allocates that power to the Assembly, presumably because it's the Assembly that elects the President. It is only fitting that the same body should have the power to remove the person elected from office. Then he says, for the impeachment process to commence, the Assembly must have determined that one of the listed grounds exists. This is so because grounds constitute conditions for the President's removal. A removal of the President where none of these grounds is established would not be a removal contemplated in this section. Equally, a process for removal of the President where none of those grounds exist would amount to a process not authorized by the section. I will jump, so I'm reading from 173 of the judgment downward. These are important pages to establish where the power lies. So I want to answer some questions which we must be brave to admit. We must not think we can if the... Okay, I'll get back to that just now. So another important line perhaps to state here is that since the power to remove is institutional, the Assembly must decide and facilitate the initiation of the preliminary stage. It may very well be that each member of the Assembly has the right to initiate the process. So that has to do with the process. I want to speak to this question of seriousness because it's addressed as well here. In their ways, in the ways of the majority judgment. 77. Okay, let's start 76. The power to remove the President from office is available to the Assembly only if one of the listed grounds available. I've already read that it is evident that the drafters left the details relating to the grounds the Assembly to spell out, but the drafters could have not contemplated that members of the Assembly would individually have to determine what constitutes a serious violation of the law or the constitutional conduct on the part of the President, which in the first place amounts to misconduct, and whether in the second place such conduct may be characterized as serious misconduct. If this were to be the opposition, then we would end up with divergent views on what is serious violation of the Constitution or the law and what amounts to serious misconduct envisaged in this section. And since the determination of these grounds falls within the exclusive jurisdiction of the Assembly, it and it alone is entitled to determine them. This means that there must be an institutional predetermination of what a ground, of what a serious violation of the Constitution or the law is. The same must apply to serious misconduct and inability to perform functions of the office. Let's leave the speaker. Once more, it is left to the Assembly to determine circumstances under which the president removed from office on one of these grounds may forbid benefits. And then finally, honorable members, for the impeachment process to commence, The assembly must determine that one of the listed grounds is established or exists. Now, so we have no option but to have our process. Even if there might be someone else out there who has a process, we are suspended. That we have to take the responsibility to have our own process. And according to this interpretation of the Constitution, or at least according to Section 89, whether we are second-guessing someone or not is no longer relevant. We must have our process. So you may as well say there's a court ruling. On the basis of the court ruling only, you can't remove the president on the basis of Section 89. You may on the basis of the motion of no confidence, but not on the basis of Section 89. So if there's a serious violation by the Constitution and we evoke Section 89, the Parliament is obliged to put that into a process. And part of the evidence that will be presented is precisely the court judgment. That here is the judgment, the president can also lead his legal evidence, and so on and so forth. So I wanted to clear that. The second point I want to clear is this minority what. In this pre-institutional predetermination, is not majorities and minorities and what. The judgment is clear. One, it says on 194, Jafta is dealing with this question of the ad hoc committee, including committees of parliament. In fact, if you read these sections from 94, 95, 96, he's outlawing. He says the committee process is not what is contemplated. The ad hoc committee process is not what is contemplated. And he gives reasons why. Because you can't arrive at facts by voting. You can arrive at what must be the punishment by voting. But the determination facts doesn't need. We can't all of us agree by a majority that this is blue when it is red. Then we are not fit to be in this house, basically. Facts must be established. So Parliament must have its process. That's our first responsibility, is to establish how that process is going to be. And it cannot be on the basis of the committees that exist in our rules, including the ad hoc committee. Now, the reason why I was disagreeing, and I thought Advocate Jafta will correct this, when he was reading the summary, Jenkins, sorry, Jafta is the justice. What he read as the principles is the summary of the Chief Justice in a minority judgment. He is summarizing what he thinks are the principles on the basis of what Justice Jafta's judgment says. No, that's not what we need. We can. That's what we have a space here to say what must be, and this is why there is no compromise or there is no textbook violation of separation of powers. What he's doing there by interpreting it that way is that he's trying to ground a wrong interpretation of the majority judgment. The majority judgment is not prescribing. It doesn't have prescriptions of this is how the rule, what the rule must say, and it must follow. So we may as well come back to the initial conversation of having, that's why I was making an example about companies. But if you think companies are minority, minority bodies in the society, the Judicial Service Commission, how does it impeach judges? And that could be the framework which we use. South Africa has already answered the question of impeachment. It's just it did in a different regime of the state. So we could look at the Judicial Service Commission Act and how judges are impeached. But the perfect example is precisely what we've been recommending when we were starting, that because of the president, even here they say he's no longer a member of the house, he only lives by the rules when he's in the house. He's in the different arm of the state. Let's get retired judges that will establish for us the facts, bring the report to Parliament, and then we vote or we debate. but on the basis, firstly, that there must be a predetermination. That predetermination doesn't have to be by members of parliament themselves. And those examples are there in other countries, in the report of other countries that we looked at. I'm just saying we have that option. It has not been taken from us. It has, if it was taken from us, it would have been a textbook case of judicial overreach. But the judges didn't do that. So we still have that option. Finally, Chairperson, I want to appreciate that there is obviously, and this is the practicality of people who have been in Parliament for a while, there's how do you process the motion? I think that's where the Speaker doesn't have to decide if it's serious or not. So nobody must decide a priori, because that's what the process must determine. So if you are a member, an ordinary member, and you believe that there must be an impeachment, you draft a motion that there must be an impeachment, that there must be a process of impeachment, and you tell the Speaker that there is one and two and three. The Speaker then subjects the process to the House. The House votes. And we're not voting on a new committee, or it must not be decided on an ad hoc basis. Then the people who process that call the president and do all of that important work of establishing effects must always, in my view, be there and be determined at the beginning of every parliament, the fifth democratic parliament, the sixth democratic, like that, like that. And it could be four or five judges, depending on which one will be available. We get that one to do the process of impeachment. And then I agree, the president must have legal representation. The president must, and that body must have the powers of subpoena. If it doesn't have the powers of subpoena, it won't be effective. But the president must have legal representation. There must be an evidence leader or indictment and all those things. It must be a proper trial. And in my view, that's what that section, that's the best way to do it without compromising majorities and what Honorable Nyami Boy was saying. If I'm chairing that committee, you know, a sitting president who is most likely, as the judgment says, who is most likely to be the party leader of the majority party in the House, may not feel that they must answer to... particularly on things that are going to impact on their removal. So to give them a fair trial, we just step aside and watch. But it is one that is owned by ourselves, is commissioned by our resolutions and reports to us, and we take the final decision of whether we remove him or her. Thank you.
Now, colleagues, can we take a 15-minute break? John, do you want to speak now after break, please?
Break. Yeah, I think that Mr. Mpofu better watch out when Dr. Ndlozi starts with his LLD next. But I mean, I think that for me, and the points I've been raising since the beginning is captured succinctly in 178. It talks about institutional predetermination. And that, to my mind, is a direction to us that we're going to have to grapple with the definition of serious violation. And that would solve the problem then of removing the power of the Speaker to decide whether it's a serious violation or not. So I think that that direction to us, and that's why I made the point originally, is that before we even start the process, we've got to have an institutional predetermination of what is serious violation. And until we grapple with that, we're not going to be able to get through the rest. So because that's going to be the first hurdle. For a motion to be deemed competent to appear before the House, Section 89 motion. I think we will get into the nuts and bolts around external committee versus internal committee, and I think there's some legal advice we're going to have to get around Parliament's role in terms of the Constitution and its responsibilities and duties, and where the President could argue that, well, it's not Parliament holding him accountable, it's an external body, and is that a valid process? We'll get into the nuts and bolts here, but to my mind, the first thing we've got to grapple with is that institutional
predetermination of what is a serious violation or serious misconduct.
Take a 15-minute break, Colin, with that seriousness. It's a very serious break, this one.
Honourable Mpofu. Honourable members, let's resume. Let us start with our meeting. It's a subcommittee of the Rules Committee. We don't take a final decision. We make recommendation to the mother body that then makes recommendation to the National Assembly. I'm not sure whether we still want to discuss seriousness and seriousness and seriousness and seriousness. And I think what we should do now is to allow the Secretary to the National Assembly to present what we are proposing, Natasha, what we propose in 2016. Then members then will comment on what we have proposed, look at it. It may also cover the question of a panel of experts, all the issues that are there. And then after that, we have a discussion. Let us then start in the, with that. And Natasha wanted to make a point before allowing. Okay.
Chair, just a quick point, because I think it's important when, and I agree with you 100%, now that we've looked at issues, then the Secretariat needs to go and put together exactly what is defined by seriousness and the nature of seriousness. But Advocate Jenkins said something which concerned me, which he reiterated a few times, and I wish he was in here to hear me, but he's not. But it's all right, because my colleagues are here, and they're the people that need to hear this. Advocate Jenkins referred to gross negligence on many occasions. Now, one thing that I noted from the judgment is that the majority judgment was very careful in the fact that it never mentioned the word negligent. In fact, the judges went so far as to say inability to perform function or inability to perform duty, but they did not use the word negligent. And that is because negligence cannot be a defense. It can't be a defense. So while our Secretariat goes and looks at how we define seriousness, we cannot say that if a president is negligent, it then absolves him from a serious misconduct or a serious contravention of the Constitution, because it's like a lifeguard saying, well, there was a pretty girl on the beach, so I turned to talk to her, and while I was talking to her, someone drowned, and I was negligent in my duty. That's not a defense. So the president can't then say, I was negligent in my duty as president, and therefore I rely on that as my defense. So when we draft these things, Chair, the Secretariat's going to have to be very careful and look at the nuances, especially of the judgment, because I think it's very telling that the word negligent is never used in that judgment. It's phrased in many ways except using the word actually negligent. Chair, then also, when the Secretariat does it, Chair, 178 of the judgment, I cannot reiterate its importance. and it starts 178, and since the determination of these matters falls within the exclusive jurisdiction of the Assembly, it and it alone is entitled to determine them. Now, that to me is it's the alpha and omega of how we take this issue forward. It is completely up to us and determined by us. So, Chair, I think we need to look at that very seriously. Chair, also, I heard someone mention, and I can't remember who it was, that we must avoid ever a frivolous motion or a frivolous attempt at impeachment. I think the fact that to bring this motion in the first place, it would have to be a substantive motion, would stop the frivolity. There we go. How's that for a tongue twister to start the year off? Ever coming, because, you know, what you don't want is it to become a political basketball that gets played with. Impeachment is not a play tool. Impeachment is a very serious issue, and it must be viewed as such. Chair, and then also, when one looks at the word debate in the House, I think the Secretariat must also be very careful in the way we word this, because it was something that was brought up in 2014. There is a difference between how we debate something in a committee and how we debate something in the House. And even in a motion of no confidence, when it's debated in the House, the person against whom the motion is aimed does not have the right of reply in the House during the debate. They would have the right of reply if it was debated in an ad hoc committee or in a portfolio committee. That would be the opportunity for the right of reply to be heard. So we must just also look at the rules, because if we as a committee decide that in an impeachment debate in the House, the President would be allowed to answer, if that's what we decide upon, we would have to perhaps then look at the way we change the debate in the House, because there is a clear differentiation between committee debate and parliamentary debate.
Honourable Mbuise.
Yes, you know, I the way you are guiding us, Honorable Mudagan, I even wondered why they didn't put you in the MEC, because you are very powerful. I mean, guiding such an important process, I don't know what happens to talent in that house, but it's okay. You know, here we are. I think that we must not overlook this disagreement, because it must be clear. We couldn't go to the rules to define seriousness. We couldn't do that. That's what must be determined by a process if the grounds for the violation of Section 89 are there. So let's read this thing again, and I want to say some shocking, maybe it's not shocking after all, but for an example, the Constitution says in Section 89, the Assembly by a resolution adopted with a supporting vote of at least two-thirds of its members may remove the President from office only on the grounds of a serious violation of the Constitution or the law, serious misconduct, inability to perform. So there might be a finding that there was a serious violation. The Constitution says we may, it doesn't say we must. That's an important reading. So an impeachment finding will say, because serious violation will include value judgments. Actually, a large part of it will include value judgment. It cannot be put in definitions of rules. And you must not be scared that we get a process that says President X has seriously violated the Constitution or the law, or is guilty of misconduct. And members of Parliament come and they don't remove them, because the Constitution says they may. So what is missing there, which is implicit there, is that they may not. They may not. So it's not they must remove. If that was the case, you know, anybody
when a court of law, for an example, says, you know, this guy is guilty of serious misconduct, it will be automatic. But it's may. And that's why Justice Jafta says this provision empowers the assembly and the assembly alone to remove the president. It's constellating on that probability. They may remove the president. So we are not tasking, or we couldn't task the secretary to go and predetermine in a form of definitions what serious misconduct, what serious violation is. Now, every impeachment process must determine on the basis of the given circumstances, which may not be predetermined, which cannot be predetermined, in fact, whether the person has seriously violated the constitution or not. I just wanted to underscore that because I think there is a slight diversion in relation to that, because I keep emphasizing that we're not to define. We put a process to constantly tell us on basis of circumstances if there are grounds for serious violation. Then we go to the house. So people who are reasonable or who are unreasonable after a credible process has said a person seriously violated the constitution, they may still keep them there. The constitution unfortunately allows it. And so I think that clarification is important. So maybe we must clarify that before we go to the proposal, Chairperson. Thank you.
Okay. Honorable Ndlozi, I think we are comfortable with that one. I think it's very helpful for us to do so, because the reason why I say set up a process is a process that is going to determine whether it's a serious or not a serious thing. Based on that, then the report to the chamber. The chamber discuss. In fact, the process can say it's serious violation. The chamber says you are mad. There's nothing serious here. They can do so, because the chamber only that will take that decision at the end, whether you impeach or not impeach. But I think what we should do, colleagues, is to allow... Shemwa, you wanted to make a point? No. Let us allow then the Secretary of the National Assembly look at it and see what you want to do. Take the platform, Masbu.
Thank you, Chair, and good afternoon, Honourable Members. I am now presenting on the document titled Additional Rules, Removal from Office of President. Chair, we'll start from part 3 of that document. I'm sure members have read the document, so I will not go through it word for word, but I'll highlight issues that I believe this structure needs to take care of.
If you go detailed to it.
Okay, no, it's fine.
Because it's guiding us again on many issues that we have already broadly debated. It just will be very important for us to take your time a little bit.
That's fine. I'll do so, Chair. Obviously, the rule numbers will be updated, because the rules have since been amended. Now, the first part, which in terms of the document is 102B1, says that the motion to remove president must be based on a recommendation to that effect by a committee of the House appointed for that purpose. The issue of the ad hoc committee has been discussed, and the court has also expressed itself on the issue of ad hoc committee. At the time, the view was that the ad hoc committee would be the best mechanism in this regard, but clearly, we need to consider the nature of the committee that must be established that will take care of this. Of course, the one option is to have a committee, a permanent structure, which would be composed as and when a matter arises. So you could have a committee with some form of terms of reference. A member may by motion propose that the assembly initiates the process for impeachment of the president. There's been a discussion as to whether it will always be incumbent on members to propose to initiate this process, or the Assembly could on its own initiate the process. I think this committee must express itself on that. Then 102C states the criteria which the motion to initiate must comply with. Now, the first one, A, deals with the role of the Speaker. Now, the court judgment has said something about a motion of this nature should not be based on the generosity of the Speaker, whether it is allowed or disallowed, which seems to suggest that the role of the Speaker at that point should be limited. So the committee would need to deal with the issue of the criteria. Criteria B or A deals with prima facie evidence that would warrant consideration by the House. B, the motion must propose that the specified charge be referred to a committee of the House. The charge must be confined to a charge contemplated in Section 89. And also, the charge should concern what President, I mean, the charge must relate to an action conducted by the President in person, not to his general functions. That's what was proposed here. And that the motion must be consistent with the Constitution, the law, the rules, and may not contain statements that are not necessary to make it intelligible. So the point that I would like to make here, Honourable Members, is we have to grapple with the vetting process. So when a member tables the motion, who vets the motion to ensure that it complies with these rules? It would have been the Speaker. We must talk about that. Or should it be the structure that will have been established to process impeachment motions that does the vetting of the motion? Non-compliance with criteria, the Speaker may disallow proposed motion, and if she or he disallows the motion, the member consent must be informed. The member can amend the motion and resubmit it. If again the motion or is not amended still does not comply, the member must be informed of the reasons for disallowing it, and also the House must be informed as to why the motion was disallowed. We then come to also a critical step in the process, the programming for consideration by the House. Now, ordinarily, at this stage, this is where a motion is either given the green light or is killed, for lack of a better word, or disagreed, or whatever, voted down by the House. Now, the question is, for this type of motion, is there room for that? Is there room for the House to block, I think that's the appropriate word, to block the motion from even getting into a process within the system? And my reading of the judgment is that that is not desirable, because in that manner you have a hurdle in the process which would effectively kill the motion, and the motion would not even be processed by a structure. So we must deal with that. Of course, you have options. One of the options would still be to go through this process, but the House would be aware that it cannot block such motions. And another process would be, once a motion of that nature is submitted, it does not go via the House, it goes directly to the committee, which must do the vetting of the motion. So that's one option. Here it said that it must be programmed on the next sitting day of the House. And if the House is not sitting for a period of more than 14 days, the Speaker may appoint an ad hoc committee. Of course, we're talking ad hoc committee at the time. So if we do not have an ad hoc committee, it will be completely different process that will be followed. Again, the scope of debate on the motion must be confined to the proposed referral of the charge to a committee and related matters, and may not extend to the charge itself, the idea being that the committee must still grapple with these issues, with the charge, and therefore the debate itself must not get into those details. 102G, invitation to President to respond. So what was envisaged here was that at the point that the House says yes, there must be a committee established, and this motion must be referred to that committee, the President is informed immediately that the committee has been established, and the details of the charge, and invite him or her to respond within 14 days. You then had the terms of reference. Unless the House determines otherwise, the terms of reference of the committee to which the charge is referred to inquire into and pronounce upon the charge. If the charge is sustained as being beyond reasonable doubt to determine its seriousness, if applicable, and to table a report. So in the proposal, it was to be the committee itself that determines the seriousness of the charge. And also there was an option given that instead of saying beyond reasonable doubt, you could say on a balance of probabilities as a test to be applied there. 102I, the committee may exercise all the powers provided for, it's now Rule 167, for purposes of carrying out its mandate and must comply with the rules. The committee must conduct its inquiry in accordance with a procedure that is reasonable and procedural fair. The president has the right to be heard in his or her own defense and to be assisted by a legal practitioner or other experts. The committee may appoint one or more legal practitioners or other experts to assist it in an advisory capacity. Now, members would be aware that the judgment says there must be a preliminary process before you delve into the detail of the process. So what if that preliminary process is conducted by this committee? You could have a situation where the committee deals with the initial part, whether it consults experts, whatever form of experts you have, and then the committee submits a preliminary report to the House to say there are grounds for proceeding with impeachment, or we do not believe that there are grounds for proceeding with impeachment. So that's how you could formulate the preliminary process. Then consideration of the report. When the report is tabled, it must be programmed for debate and decision in the House without delay. And of course, this is at the end of the process. The committee comes back with a report. And if the committee recommends in its report that the president be removed from office, the question must be voted on in the House. And if it is supported by at least 2/3 of the members of the House, the president is thereby duly removed from office with immediate effect. What the rules did not deal with is the mode of voting in the House. And it's another issue that arose with the motion of no confidence. And it's a matter that the committee might want to consider the mode of voting with regard to this motion. Mr. Ngwangwa, I'm still presenting. Removal of president from office in the case of inability to perform the functions of the office. For purposes of proceedings of the president to remove the president from office in the case of president's inability to perform the functions of the office, the term charged in the rules must be understood as the grounds for averring the president's inability to perform the functions of office. If in relation to a charge, in terms of Section 89, the president is unable to comply fully with these rules in person, the committee may, in a preliminary report to the House, recommend that another person be authorized to act for the president in these proceedings. Honorable members, the issue of panel was discussed by the committee. And a legal opinion to that effect was also obtained. What the legal opinion effectively said was that, look, these processes must be led by members of parliament. However, you could have a panel whose terms of reference would still need to be defined, which would act in an advisory capacity to a committee of parliament. So that matter was discussed at that point when the committee dealt with these proposals. So, Chair, these are the proposals that were developed at the time. Obviously, they have to be updated to be in line with the judgment. I have sought to give certain options. So, in summary, there's a motion by a member. The committee must decide what happens to that motion. The motion must comply, obviously, with certain guidelines. Does it go directly to the House? And I'm putting a question mark there. Does it go to the House for the House to vote on the motion? And when it votes on the motion, can say yes or no. So we must be aware of that. Or you have a motion which would then be directed to a structure established to consider Section 89 issues. And that structure does the assessment, the vetting of the motion. And the structure says, we don't think that, we think this is a frivolous motion. Therefore, we should do nothing with it. Or we think, okay, it's not frivolous, but it does not sufficiently contain the basis for impeachment. Or we think there is sufficient basis for impeachment, and therefore the impeachment process must be embarked on. And of course, that the nature of that committee, because remember, there's the issue of proportionality. You need to discuss that. Does it consult experts at that point before it comes to the preliminary report to the House and before you embark on the full impeachment process? So once the committee says, let's say the committee says, yes, go ahead, and there's agreement that you go ahead, you then get into the detail of the impeachment where you have hearings and whatever else you want to have in that process. So that's how I see the process, Chair. And at the end, it comes to the House. The two-thirds applies at that point when the committee has concluded its processes, reports to the House, then that's where you then have the two-thirds. If two-thirds says yes, then the motion is carried. Chair, thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much, Masubu, for the presentation. Let us invite members to comment on the presentation. Honorable Carter.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. Chair, I think just one important thing that I don't, you know, that I would have liked to see here is if we go to the Mogoeng judgment of the 22nd of June, which was specifically on secret